Let's have the Judiciary Committee come to order. It's 1:35 on the afternoon of Monday, March 30th, 2009. We have a quorum to conduct business. Senator McGuire is here, Senator Terrio, Senator Wilikowski, myself, Senator French. We have two bills scheduled for today, SB 48, Meetings of Road Service Area Boards, and SB 148, Liability for Tribal Road Construction. Before we get to that, though, we did hold over one bill from last Friday, SB 47, relating to the statute of limitations, in order for Senator Terrio to take a look at the fiscal notes and see if he had any questions or concerns about them. Senator Terrio?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did speak to risk management, and it seems it's one of those things that it's an unknown, but fairly small unknown. So at this point, I'm okay with moving the bill out. Thank you for holding it, though.
Appreciate that. And with that, I would solicit a motion to move SB 47.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move Senate Bill 47 with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes out of the Judiciary Committee.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the bill is moved. We'll take a brief at ease while we do the paperwork. Back on the record, and now the next bill is going to be SB 148, brought to us by the senator from the Senate Transportation Committee by request. Senator Albert Kukesh is the sponsor. We have one of his lovely staffers here. Please welcome to the committee. Nice to have you here today. Please put yourself on the record, and we'll be eager to hear your testimony.
Well, thank you. My name is Dorothy Shockley, legislative staff to Senator Albert Kukesh, who is, well, hopefully en route from Angoon. Thank you so much for hearing this bill. Senate Bill 148 will resolve the issue of liability to the state or employees of the state when partnering with federally recognized tribes under the Indian Reservation Roads Program. With the decline in state and federal highway funds, it's imperative we collaborate and work together. This bill will assist the partnering process and ultimately benefit all Alaskans by leading to long-term improvements in the state's overall transportation infrastructure. And as you can see from one of the lists, tribes have received over, well, $36 or $45 million, and with the additional $40 million through the stimulus. And as DOT prepares for the next step, first-time tribes can bring both matching funds and maintenance funds, and this will just move the working relationship along and allow both state and federal funds to be used on highways. So it's pretty simple, and appreciate your support.
Ms. Shockley, thank you. Any other any questions for the bill's sponsor? We do have Peter Putzier from the Department of Law to answer questions, as well as Mark O'Brien from .puff. We've got a couple other folks signed up to testify, but we do have two experts on the line to handle questions. Oh, actually, I see Mr. Putzier is right here. And maybe like what Mr. O'Brien, are you here as well?
Yes.
Thanks so much. Very good. Why don't we have, maybe we'll start with you, Mr. Putzier, and answer a couple legal questions about how the bill would work, and then we'll turn to public testimony in just a few moments. Welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And for the record, my name is Peter, and the last name is Putzier, spelled P-U-T as in tango, Z-I-E-R. I'm with the Alaska Department of Law.
Maybe you can explain where this would apply, to whom it would apply, and what would happen in the event of, say, a road that was built wrongly and someone wanted to sue to recover for, the poor construction or something along those lines.
This would apply in circumstances where a tribe is performing work under the Indian Reservation Roads Program. The program has been around for a while, but the tribes are now much more well-funded, and with some recent changes in the law, most notably in the safety law in 2005, funds are available. I think it's in the order of about, roughly, I'm ballparking, about $100 million in the state of Alaska. Now that's spread out over a number of tribes. As you know, there are 229, or roughly 230 federally recognized tribes in the state of Alaska. But they're able to now perform work on state roads, and when they did that, pursuant to this Indian Reservation Road Program, that's where this legislation would fit in. Now, there are different kinds of partnering relationships. One option that's been discussed is the tribe simply using 100% federal funds, their own personnel, to do the work. And in that situation,
and let me just jump in and say, where would this work be taking place? Is this?
Well, the Indian Reservation Roads, the definition of it, said that it's, and I'm just kind of paraphrasing here, it's roads on a reservation or, with reference to the state of Alaska, roads leading to or from an Alaska Native village. And what that has done is opened up the door where we have many state roads that have been denominated as Indian reservation roads. So it could be either roads that are off the state system, but in many instances we will have roads on the state system that are typically maintained by state of Alaska DOT, and the tribes have expressed an interest in possibly taking over some of those maintenance activities.
So it, for example, up near Mentasta, in that area, is that a stretch of what I think of as being state highway that would fall under or could potentially fall under this bill?
It could potentially, yes.
And what would determine whether it did fall?
Well, the tribes have to go through a process where a road is formally denominated as an Indian reservation road that is on a particular tribe's inventory, and that process goes through the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and they have to, I'm not sure of all the technical details, but basically there's a nomination procedure where they submit a list identifying sections of road that they want to include on their tribal inventory.
And is BIA the final sort of arbiter of that question? That is, once BIA blesses that denomination, what's the state's input into that decision?
The state doesn't have any input into that decision. We were asked at an early point in time to certify certain state roads as Indian reservation roads, and there was a considerable discussion back and forth in terms of what that certification ought to say. Ultimately, we simply provided a listing of public roads in the state of Alaska without providing a specific certification. Then tribes use the public listing of roads to proceed and identify various roads that they consider to be Indian reservation roads.
So if I understand what you just said, the state sort of elected not to make, and I'll editorialize, the hard choices and simply turned over a list of, is it all state roads?
Well, the state didn't really have any direct role in specifying certain segment of roads as being Indian reservation roads or not. That's not up to the state to decide. We were asked to provide a certification that the roads were Indian reservation roads, and we weren't sure of the ramifications of providing such a certification.
Let me ask it another way. What? How many miles of state roads were on the list that you turned over to the Bureau of Indian Affairs?
I believe it was all state roads in the state of Alaska, and I don't know the number of miles.
Seward Highway, Glen Highway, yes. Sterling Highway.
Correct.
Okay, got it. So you basically turned the universe of state roads over to BIA, and now it's up to them to make the final decision as to which segments of those roads this bill would apply.
We really didn't turn over anything to the BIA. We simply said, here's a public listing of roads, without making a comment as to anything other than, this is publicly available information that you or any member of this committee or any member of the public could obtain from Alaska DOT, and said, these are the roads in the state of Alaska.
What's the administration's position on this bill?
I believe the administration supports this bill.
And when you say believe, are you just being cautious because you haven't asked, or?
In my prior discussions, there's been support for this bill. This didn't come in, as my understanding, as a governor's bill. It came in through Senator Kukesh, but certainly DOT supports this bill.
Okay. Senator Terrio and then Senator Wilikowski.
I'm just wondering, when it says Senate Transportation by request, so that was not at the request of the administration?
I think we have someone who might be able to shed light on this. Welcome to the committee.
For the record, my name is Mary Sirocki, and I'm the legislative liaison for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. Through the chair, Senator Terrio, this was at the request of the administration, the Department of Transportation.
Okay, thank you.
Follow up on that, Senator Terrio. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. So what is the ability of an individual to sue a tribe?
In this case, the tribes would be essentially standing in the shoes of the federal government, would be considered employees of the federal government. So if there were litigation, the tribe would be sued, and then the federal government, Department of Justice, would intervene and take over the defense of the case. A person would be able to maintain an action pursuant to the Federal Tort Claims Act, which is a waiver of federal government's liability to certain causes of action similar to what the state of Alaska has. So a lawsuit could be maintained against the tribe.
I could, Mr. Chair, I may have a series of questions.
Sure.
So under the Federal Tort Claims Act, are there limitations on the amounts that a person can recover?
Well, again, it's similar to the state in that you get compensatory damages. I don't believe those are capped, but I think we also have someone on the line who might be able to speak to that. And there's no punitive damages. That, again, is similar to state of Alaska recovery.
Are the limits under the Federal Tort Claims Act different than what they are under the State Tort Claims Act for these types of actions?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I don't know the answer to that.
Is there someone online that would know the answer to that, Mr. Chair? I'm wondering.
Let's ask more broadly. It looks like the people who are online are just to testify for the bill. I guess I would turn back to Mr. Putz here and say, if you don't know today, perhaps you can find out soon.
That would be relatively easy to find out. Yes.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. And maybe some more questions, Mr. Chair. So, how common is our lawsuits over claims arising out of design, operations, maintenance, or construction activities pertaining to roads?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, it's very common. Our tort section, with whom we've had a number of discussions, we get sued over accidents on highways all the time. So it's quite common to have litigation arising on highways.
And I guess I just got a letter from a constituent, a very angry letter from a constituent who was complaining about the ruts on the Glen Highway, and they were driving along, got into an accident. Would we be taking away Alaskans' rights to sue by passing this? I guess that's really what I'm trying to get at. I understand that there's sort of a balance here, but at the same time, I want to make sure that Alaskans are protected and not losing a constitutional right to go and file a lawsuit if they've been wronged.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I think that's a good point. And the bill doesn't relieve the state of Alaska for its own negligence. For example, prior to a state undertaking a project, if there was a design error that occurred 5 years ago, that was caused by the state, and if the ruts, if there were an argument that because of something that the state did, the ruts existed, and they knew or should have known about the ruts, or there was a design error, those kinds of lawsuits against the state would still be available. The idea of the bill is if that a project is undertaken and it's managed by or conducted by a tribe, actions arising out of that work couldn't be brought against the state, but an individual could then, in that instance, sue the tribe. So it's not a what I would call a get-out-of-jail-free card for the state of Alaska. The state of Alaska would remain liable for certain causes of action.
And lawsuits brought against tribes in these types of actions, would they have to be brought in federal district court?
My understanding of how the Federal Tort Claims Act operates is that in the first instance one has to file an administrative claim. against the agency for whom the tribe is working. So I think typically that would be the Federal Highway Administration, and then the Federal Highway Administration has in the order of 6 months to process the claim. And then if the claim is not resolved at that level, an individual would have the right to sue in federal district court.
So there's no ability to sue in state district court or in state court?
Not under the Federal Tort Claims Act, that's my understanding, yes.
Are the statute of limitations different under the Federal Tort Claims Act than under the State Tort Claims Act?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski. I could get you the answer. I don't have that right now. I believe it differs in some respects.
I'd be interested in getting that as well, Mr. Chair. And did you say you would get us a list of the roads that would be impacted by this?
Do you want a list of state, through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, do you want a list of state roads or a list of IRR roads?
I guess I'd be interested in knowing the breadth and depth of which roads this is going to impact. Is this going to impact, I know you mentioned some before, I'd be curious if it was going to impact some of the sort of major roads along the rail belt in particular. In my area, I represent Anchorage, I'd be curious if it would impact any roads in Anchorage, for instance, but I'm sure others would be interested in maybe if it's going to impact roads in Fairbanks or Juneau, major state roads.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I think the answer to that's going to be unequivocally yes. For example, sections of the Glen Highway are now an IRR road. We can get you an answer, but I'm sure that answer is going to be yes.
And I guess I would just express a little bit of concern that you get in an accident on the Glen and you have a lawsuit, and maybe if it occurred maybe you have to file a Federal Tort Claims Act, but if it occurs a half mile or even 100 yards down in either direction, maybe it's not a Federal Tort Claims Act. And I just think this is creating somewhat of a maze for Alaskans to have to navigate to figure out who they need to sue, what procedures they need to go through to file a lawsuit. So I guess I would just raise that concern. And I think I'll stop right there for now, Mr. Chair.
I've got a question. Thanks. Is this the sort of provision that you would see done on behalf of the contractors that the state employs to construct and build its roads? Does that make sense?
Mr. Chairman, when DOT contracts with a contractor, that's a different situation. We get insurance, and we ask to be, DOT asked to be named as an additional insured is usually how it is covered.
So if there's an accident on a road that the state has built through one of its contractors, the lawsuit, which alleges a poorly designed road, ultimately will follow up an insurance policy to its end.
That's correct. Typically, the state is sued, the contractor is sued, the state will tender the defense to the contractor, and
you built it, you defend it.
That's correct.
Kind of thing. And in this case, the state's going to say, you built it, go to federal court and go seek your damages there.
In this case, the state, Mr. Chairman,
I would
emphasize that this case is slightly different from the normal construction project we'd have. We're literally talking about turning over construction and not actively participating. And so the tribe would be using 100% federal funds in its own resources, which is different from our normal construction contract where we have some degree of oversight and monitoring. So it's a little bit different scenario. It's a government-to-government relationship.
I can see the attraction. You get federal funds, you get more work for the tribes. Those are all good things. There's not even a 90-10 match, right? It's pure federal dollars.
Mr. Chairman, there's the opportunity for match, I believe, and the tribes could speak to this directly, and I see some tribal representatives here in the audience, but I believe the goal is to build their own transportation abilities and expertise. So there's a desire to try as much as possible to do the work themselves.
Last question from me, and then I'll let Senator Wilkowski ask a question. Is this type of legislation mandated by Safety Lou? And I guess the other way of asking that is this bill being pushed in state legislatures across the country, or at least states that have federal tribes and the desire to get some money funneled through them to the roads?
Mr. Chairman, this is not required. And because it's such a new program, I think all of the states right now are trying to figure out how that state-tribal relationship is going to occur. And Alaska, of course, is a little bit different because we don't have reservations here, kind of raising our own peculiar issue that we discussed. The IR roads can be roads leading to or from villages, and that complicates the entire jurisdictional puzzle, if you will, and application of this program. So turning to the lower 48, even if we looked, it's not necessarily going to be a clear analogy to the kinds of issues we're facing.
This is why we get the big bucks.
That's right.
Senator Wilkowski.
You asked my question, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
About the big bucks?
No. About the requirement, about the strings.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Putzier, for that help. We also do have Mr. O'Brien here, but I think the questions that we posed have been more or less handled there. Why don't we turn to public testimony, let some of the folks who signed up testify who want to. And here in the room, I have Gordon Jackson. Welcome to the committee. Please put yourself on the record, and
all right.
We'd be happy to hear from you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Gordon Jackson. I'm the Director of Roads and Transportation for the Central Council Tlingit-Haida Indians of Alaska. We're one of the largest federally recognized tribes in Alaska with 27,000 members, with about 25 million in budgets, 250 employees. And this piece of legislation is really important to us. The bill would shield the state from lawsuits arising from the Indian Reservation roads and other federal tribal transportation projects in the state. And if the bill is enacted, it would resolve the state's lingering concerns about its potential liability from these projects. Without the bill, it appears the state may continue to insist that model maintenance agreement requires states to the tribes to carry a significant amount of the general liability insurance coverage to protect the state, insurance that may be costly and difficult to obtain. We're just being real proactive on this. If you looked at these model maintenance agreements, they're very thick and takes a considerable amount of negotiations to get that whole thing done. This enables us to go ahead with these various projects in a speedy manner. And I believe this would help just about everybody in the state. To answer some of your questions that occurred earlier, we do inventory on a local basis for the region here in the city and borough of Juneau. We do take the inventory of roads belonging to the borough of the state, but we also enter into a memorandum of agreement with the city and borough of Juneau, and that has been done with the city of Sitka, the city of Ketchikan, and others. And the memorandum of agreement basically says, you know, we will coordinate, cooperate with the design and everything relating to the roads. And where possible, we would provide matching, we would fund some of the projects and stuff like that. But it's a real coordinating and cooperative agreement. We are waiting for the city and borough to send back their comments relating to our draft and things like that. We have also sent a memorandum of agreement to the state, basically trying to do these kind of things. But at locally, many of them have been doing exactly that, because reservation roads money is increasing. We have been following the stimulus packages for the last 9 months and have been putting in some of the projects. And we have looked at a lot of that, and there's about $320 million available nationally to Indian Reservation Road programs. So there's significant potential available to many of us, and we just like to ensure that we're proactive and the state and us are protected, and we can move ahead cooperatively with many of these projects. And we fully endorse this bill, and we look forward to its enactment. Thank you very much.
Mr. Jackson, maybe you can tell me, if you have a minute, where you think some of these roads might, or some of these monies might get spent. I mean, do you have projects in mind? Have you got stuff that you're excited about getting fixed if this money suddenly, if these legalisms get cleared up and you're ready to go to work?
Oh, there's a lot of trails, you know, that the city and borough of Juneau has been talking to us about. There's been some need for marine highway terminals. There's also some need for terminal buildings in some of these airports. And if you look at these terminal buildings, for instance, the community of Cake has a three-sided terminal building that the community dragged up to the terminal building, and it's been there for the last 20 years. It's an old jail. And we always joke at each other that all of us waiting for the ferry and Cake, waiting in jail to get on the ferry. But, you know, it's those kind of needs that we need to have a look at. And we want to put that, we've put that in our inventory and have spoke to the Department of Transportation Marine Highway Division, and we've been talking about these kinds of projects. But it's very cordial. You know, we don't want to make waves. We just want to make sure, you know, that if money's coming to the state, let's work together. And that's in that vein. That's how we've been working, and the way it will continue to work.
Excellent. Thank you. Any other questions? I don't see any. Thanks for coming in to testify today.
Yeah, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
We've got three people online who want to testify. And let's go first to Chickalone Native Village, where we have Kay Mawson Goins on the line. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senators.
Go ahead and put yourself on the record. Tell us who you're affiliated with, and we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Thanks. Yes, my name is Kay Mawson Goins. I'm an attorney in Anchorage with the law firm of Sanofsky Chambers, Saxby, Miller & Munson, and I'm testifying today on behalf of the Native Village of Chickalone, one of our clients. Strongly in favor of this piece of legislation. I do want to emphasize that this bill is really needed on behalf of not only Chickalone, but a consortium of six or seven Native villages involved in the IRR program. Our firm has been negotiating with the state for more than a year, trying to reach agreement on a proposed model maintenance agreement under which the tribal entities could maintain state-owned roads. And we've achieved agreement on lots and lots of things, but liability of the state remains, I would have to say, the major sticking point. We have not been able to resolve that concern, and it is our hope that passing this bill will resolve the state's concerns enough that these projects can go forward. A lot of these projects would be very small in scope, given the number of Alaska Native Village tribes and the amount of money available. Some of these projects will be only $30,000 or $40,000 little road maintenance projects in remote parts of the state. And given the small size of those projects, it's very difficult for these tribes to seek or obtain any kind of liability insurance of the type that the state would normally require for non-tribal contractors. And for the tribal contractors, it's simply not necessary because, as Mr. Putzier explained, they are treated as if they are agencies of the federal government, and their employees are treated as if they were federal employees when they carry out these projects. And so the Federal Tort Claims Act coverage kicks in and makes it, gives protection to the traveling public and makes it unnecessary for the tribes to carry insurance to protect themselves from liability. So we really hope that this bill will pass and that we can get this state liability concern behind us and move on to bring these IRR funds into the state and put them at work here in Alaska.
Thank you. And I'm sorry, pronounce your name again for me again so I don't say it wrong.
That's right. It's Kay Gowans.
Gowans, Ms. Gowans. Thank you. And just again so I'm clear, though, were an accident to happen on part of a road that had been designed, operated, or maintained by one of the tribes under this agreement, the citizen under the Federal Tort Claims Act would sue who, the federal government or the tribe?
Well, technically the federal government, but the way this often would go, I expect, would be because the federal government's presence isn't obvious there. If a claim were presented to the tribe, under federal regulations that govern this would have an obligation to forward that claim to the appropriate office in the relevant federal agency, which here I think would be the Federal Highway Administration. And the Federal Highway Administration would then kick it into the whole Federal Tort Claims Act process, which, as Mr. Putzier said, means that ultimately the Department of Justice would step in and handle any lawsuit that gets filed.
But just so I'm clear, the from the citizen's perspective, you know, you sue the state, you know it's going to be uphill work, but ultimately, you know, the state's going to pay. You know, you sue the feds, again, it's uphill work, but, you know, they print money, so eventually you'll get paid. If for some reason you wind up suing a tribe, you know, what assurances does the citizen have that there'll be a pot of money to pay the claim?
Well, I guess the assurance that under the federal regulations, the tribes are supposed to submit those claims to the federal government, and then they are claims against the government by operation of law, and so the federal government is on the hook for any payment that ultimately has to be made on those claims.
Okay, that's I guess that's reassuring, in a way.
Senator, good. Yeah, I hope it is. It should be, I think.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a follow-up to that. So the tribes don't have to have insurance.
That's correct. The Indian Self-Determination Act is the applicable law here, and that law provides this Federal Tort Claims Act coverage for not only these Indian Reservation Road programs, but programs that tribes carry out pursuant to the Indian Self-Determination Act or in accordance with that law. And the idea there was, because we've got Indian tribes taking over federal Indian programs that the federal government used to provide directly, and the federal agencies providing those were covered by the Federal Tort Claims Act, and the federal agencies don't have to go out and spend their limited allocation of monies on purchasing insurance, that those same protections should apply when the tribes are carrying out the programs. So the FTCA provision makes a lot of sense. It prevents the tribes from having to spend their limited resources on buying insurance, and still it protects the traveling public.
And let's and please excuse my ignorance, but this is kind of going back to first year law school, but let's say there's an accident and somebody wants to sue another driver, which would be a state claim, probably a state court, and then they also think maybe there was negligent construction or maintenance of the road. Would that cause the entire claim to get dragged into federal district court then? Was that enough to break? I'm assuming it is enough to break.
You know, I'm a little bit, I should apologize because I may be at about first year law student level in some ways on some of these issues. I'm not a federal government lawyer. I don't defend the Federal Tort Claims Act cases, but my understanding, and I'm hoping Mr. Putzier is still there and can correct me if this doesn't sound right, but I believe that if the action were filed in state court, somebody sues both the driver and the tribe, or maybe they realize it's federal government in state court, the tribe would let the federal government know, the federal government would step in, and they would have that action removed to federal district court, and I believe the whole case would go. But, you know, under the Federal Tort Claims Act, state substantive law on liability applies. So, you know, it's this kind of mix of federal procedures and state substantive law. One of the biggest difference, I think, between how those things would normally go and how they would go under the Federal Tort Claims Act is this administrative process
And if you know, would the limits, the Federal Tort Claims Act limits in that scenario would only apply to the tribe, but would not apply to the third party who maybe was driving another car and caused the accident?
I believe that's correct. And I don't know of any dollar limits on these claims. The Federal Tort Claims Act does not allow you to pursue punitive damage claims against the federal government, but I don't know of any cash dollar amount limits. And it's a 2-year statute of limitations for filing the claim, which I think is the same as in state tort law.
And if I can follow, Mr. Chair, it's a 2-year statute of filing claim, but is there a certain time limit in which you have to notify the administrative agency?
I should check, but I believe, and I can get back to you on it if you like, Senator, but I believe it's 2 years to originally file the claim with the administrative agency, and then that agency has 6 months to act on the claim.
And do we know, do they typically act within 6 months, or do they frequently delay matters?
Oh, I think they do act within 6 months, yes.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions for Ms. Gowans? Thank you for your informative answers today. I appreciate you being online.
Thank you for the opportunity.
We have two other individuals. One, Howard Mermelstein from the Tetlin Tribe. Sir, are you on the line?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Senator.
Go ahead and put yourself on the record. Let us know who you're affiliated with, and we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Howard Mermelstein. I'm the director for the Tetlin Department of DOT, Tetlin's Indian Tribe, located just southeast of Tok. I'm also the primary representative for the Intertribal Transportation Association for the Alaska region, as well as several other tribal transportation things that I serve on. I first like to say that I've called in to testify to speak out in support of this bill, and I have answers to some of the questions that were asked proceeding up to this point, if the senators are still looking for some clarification, particularly in regards to what's on the inventory and the liability issue and what it actually encompasses.
Sure, we'd be happy to hear from you about that.
Right. The for as far as what's on the inventory itself, the way the CFR 25 Part 170 regulations governing the Indian Reservation Roads Program reads is that any road that provides access, primary access or access to goods and services for Native Americans or Alaska Natives are eligible to be included in the inventory. In having done that and having worked with Deputy Commissioner McKinnon and Peter 2 years ago to get the letter from the state that basically said this is a list of federal roads, the tribe would then submit an inventory document to the BIA, and the BIA has parameters for what goes into the system and what doesn't, and the roads that are owned by the state go into the system as state-owned roads, and the tribes generate just 5% of a cost to construct on the road. Now, in our case, we have part of the Alaska Highway that runs through the former Tetlin Reservation, which Tetlin opted out of ANCSA and kept its lands, is in the system. The system only generates a small amount of funding. As far as liability, only if the Tetlin tribe approached the state, because the state has to give full consent to any work that's done on its routes. If they approach the state in regards to an issue on the state route, whether it was the Alaska or Taylor Highway, if the tribe simply partnered funding and gave the funding to the state, the traveling public would then only go to the state for any resolve of any possible litigation issues, because the tribe is just providing funding and allowing the state to deal with design, construction, and continued maintenance. If the tribe went to the state and asked for permission to fill in some potholes or reconstruct a segment of road, it would only be that portion of road that would be subject to the litigation going over to the tribes, and then to the federal government through the Tort Claims Act. And the tribes must follow the federal highway regulations, guarantee that the tribes must meet or exceed state or federal standards for road construction, because we're still using the same pot of funds you are, federal highway dollars from the highway tax trust fund. So it's very important that this pass so we can move forward with the tribes that have been trying to meet projects with the state's help. And Mr. O'Brien and Mr. Putz here have been very helpful in working with us to move this along, because we do bring in $50 million a year into the state when you count the other high-priority project funding that comes. So hopefully that answers the question and concern about liability. The traveling public will always have a place to turn. And for the most part, for the main state routes where you express concern of the Glenn Highway, the Alaska Highway, the tribes aren't, and we're not interested in doing major work or any work on the Alaska Highway. It's maintained, you know, most of these roads are maintained well above standard. But where the tribe would be interested in maybe putting up some signage or some safety signs on the Alaska Highway, by these roads being in the tribal inventory, the tribe is then in a position to partner and deliver funds to the state DOT if the tribes in the state have this in place. So hopefully that clarifies some of the concerns regarding litigation and where traveling public would turn. Because unless the tribe designs or constructs the road, it's going to be designed and constructed by the state for the most part, especially these larger routes. The more rural, isolated routes are the ones we're looking to have projects streamlined for tribes to be able to conduct maintenance and repairs.
Thank you. Senator Terrio has a question.
Thank you. You mentioned that you used the terminology any road providing access. How broadly is road interpreted? Because we did have Mr. Jackson that talked about some trails that are being considered, and I'm just curious, in a number of the communities that are not connected to the highway system, there might be a road from the airport into the post office, and then it's boardwalks throughout the community. Would they qualify?
Boardwalks, officially reclassified now, ones that are over 12 feet wide have been reclassified as board roads. A lot of those are in the system. And I can speak for one of the villages I represent, Kasigaluk. They have 2 miles of board roads in the system. And that allows the tribe to maintain those board roads. And those board roads were actually built by the BIA. So it would design on those roads would still have to meet or exceed accepted standards. And if the tribe and their contractors carried out the design, then it would fall under the under the protection of the tribes and the federal government's Legal Tort Claims Act. As far as the trails, when BIADOT in Albuquerque makes the final determination on what is allowed to go into the inventory, in many instances, trails fall in under the classification of motorized trails. And then that allows the tribes to spend their funds to try to upgrade those trails or make them safe. If they're going to go into a design process and have those trails widened out and constructed into roadways, depending on the land ownership, you know, you have to start with your right-of-way acquisition and go through the same process as the state would if the state was going to change a trail to a road. But the trails that are owned by the state, in order for a tribe to put them on their inventory, those trails would have to be identified as being owned by the state. If our trail system is completely within the tribe's lands, for those that have lands, such as Tetlin, where we have close to 800,000 acres, or tribes that don't have lands and only have ANCSA lands, the corporation lands are acceptable for the input as long as the corporation provides a letter acknowledging access to their lands, that it's okay for the general, because once it's in the inventory, these roads and trails are open to the general public 24/7, and a tribe can no longer put the gate up. You know, it used to be where a tribe could block access. If a tribe puts something into its inventory and it's on the Indian Reservation Roads Program inventory, it is then open to the general public 24/7, as would be any other road in the state, you know, assuming that it's maintained passable. But, you know, I couldn't drive down it and then throw the gate up prohibiting you to not come through. Like the road to Tetlin is now open for the traveling public since it's been adopted into the inventory.
Thank you. So, on the boardwalks, they have to be at least 12 feet. And if you've got a boardwalk that's less, could they nominate that for a project to widen it and put it on the system?
Yes. The ones that are less are still classified as boardwalks and are typically in as a Class 8 or a Class 6 other city street or other city trail or community trail. And then the ones that are 12 feet wide are in as board roads, and they generate at a different rate.
Thank you.
And it's all the rate generation on what a tribe receives through the funding formula is all based on population and vehicle miles traveled and length of sections. It's very complicated, but it's just a small percentage.
I'm actually glad you brought that up, because I was just looking at an addendum to the materials we received from the bill sponsor, a table showing the list of tribes and the amount of money that would go to each under what looks like a 2008 allocation. And I guess it's worth pointing out that at least with respect to tribes on the major road systems, which is where I sense some of the committee's concern, the amounts of money available are fairly modest, which would suggest that there's not going to be a wholesale substitution of the tribes in the place of the state as far as construction, design, and maintenance goes. I'll just point out that Chicoloon looks like it's in line for $580,000. Iklutna tribe is in line for, if I'm reading it right, a total of $42,000 and so forth. I mean, there's lots of tribes and lots of money. In total, it looks like a total of $36 million, which is a huge amount of work. But at least each individual tribe gets what looks to be like a fairly modest amount of money.
Right. The formula is based upon, like I said, it's the tribe's roads that are owned by it, as well as what's in its inventory that's owned by the state or borough, population, and vehicle miles traveled based mostly on default values that's been set up by Federal Highways, because in most cases for the villages, the default values exceed the actual traffic count. Right, where Chicoloon is in line for a larger portion of funding, that is because Chicoloon has been proactive for many years in getting their roads through their lands into the system. Whereas other villages, Northway, for example, gets about $28,000 before a population adjustment factor comes in. And they haven't been as active getting in their roads to this point, because it's only since 2005 has there been, or actually August 2006, has there been a tribal share available. So tribes are relatively, except for a handful of us, about a dozen, most tribes are relatively new at this. Now, for example, the four tribes on Prince of Wales Islands, Kasan, Craig, there's a couple more, I'm not sure what they are exactly. Between the four of them, they generate almost $7 million that they are interested in working and matching with the state to improve their system. And they've been more proactive for many years. Hence, they have larger fund generation. As the program grows each year, more and more funding comes into the state. You know, next year, if everything, or this fiscal year, for fiscal year 09, we should be looking at about $54 million into the state of Alaska through its tribal governments for road development.
Okay, thank you. Any closing comments you'd like to make to the committee?
No, just that we support this bill, and it's very important, and we would appreciate your support in moving it forward in a timely fashion.
You're very knowledgeable on the subject. I appreciate you taking the time to call in. It's been helpful. Finally, we have Johnny Ambrose, who has signed up to testify from the Ruby Tribal Council. Mr. Ambrose, are you on the line?
Yes, sir.
Go ahead and put yourself on the record. Tell us with whom you are affiliated, and we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
I work for Ruby Tribal Council. My name is Johnny Ambrose. I'm a tribal technician, transportation technician for the Ruby Tribal Council. And we support this bill. We think it's very important. At this time, I wish I knew way more about this Senate Bill 148. But I've only been with the transportation program just a little over a year. I still got quite a bit to catch up on quite a bit to learn about it. And the tribal administrator had me log in and participate. It sounds like it's a little bit confusing for me, but I just got to keep at it and keep trying to catch on to what you guys are talking about. And we just want to know that this bill is important, and we want it to pass. And that was about all I had to say. And I was wondering if you guys could email me stuff about this bill. My email address is rubyirr@gmail.com. You know, so I could read literature on it.
I will ask that the bill sponsor sends you a packet. We'll get your email to them, Mr. Ambrose. And I would suggest you reach out and make contact with Mr. Mermelstein, because he would seem like a wealth of information, at least to me. He's in Tetlin. Okay, that brings.
Okay.
Yep.
I went to a few transportation trainings, and one of the things that I always hear over and over is it takes about 2-3 years, you know, to really get caught up in all this transportation language. It's a whole different language, and I don't think a year and a couple of months was real ample time for me to really be all knowed up on transportation, but I'm just going to keep at it.
That's good advice. I would encourage you to do that. Thanks, Mr. Ambrose, for calling in. Thank you.
Okay. You're welcome.
Is there anyone else on the line who'd like to testify about SB 148? Anyone else here in the room who'd like to testify on SB 148? Hearing and seeing none, I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony. I would like to hear from a plaintiff's attorney. I think I've got a pretty good handle on what the bill does, why it's necessary. I feel like it's contained in a way that I understand. But I do want to, before we move the bill out of this committee, hear from someone who practices on behalf of plaintiffs, just to get their perspective on what this might mean for the traveling public. So we will hold the bill over and bring it up as soon as possible. I know there's some concern about moving it along. I share that concern, but I do want to hear from that wing of the legal world. So with that, we will hold the bill over and turn now to SB 48, CS for SB 48, brought to us by Senator Terrio. And the first order of business, I believe, is to adopt the correct CS, which I understand is /P, like in potato. Is that correct, Senator Terrio?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
I would solicit a motion to adopt /P.
So moved.
Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, /P is the working document. Senator Terry, we'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The adoption of this as a working document narrows the scope of the bill. You can see now that in the two sections of the bill on page 2, lines 11 through 13, we have narrowed it so that it now applies to only municipal service area boards that are established. Earlier versions of the legislation talked about other other boards and commissions of a local government, and there was some thought that that was just too broad. This pulls it back to the original concept that I put the legislation in on, that is primarily to give some relief to service area commissioners who are generally volunteers trying to decide when to remove the hard pack snow on the road or replace a culvert that's about to wash out. And in trying to make those decisions under the current law, they are precluded with talking to each other, and this would offer them some relief.
And just so I'm and I and the record are clear, this is an exemption from the open meetings laws, correct?
That's correct.
Very good. Okay. That's what I thought. I just want to make sure we had that down. Any questions from members of the committee for the bill sponsor? We do have Kathy Wasserman here, who'd like to testify. Ms. Wasserman, please come forward. Welcome to the committee. You know the drill.
Yes.
Nice to see you. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Kathy Wasserman. I'm with the Alaska Municipal League. We have passed this a resolution in favor of this bill. I faxed that to you earlier. As you will notice, the resolution is not signed. We just passed it the other day, and we have to send it via snail mail to Nome, and obviously we don't have that back yet.
Yeah, Iditarod finished a couple days ago.
I know. I don't know what she's doing up there, but I think it's the, you know, volcano thing. But we obviously are in favor of helping municipalities do jobs well. And while we respect and support the Open Meetings Act, we also felt that this was a little bit, this was hampering service road and fire service road areas of conducting business. If two people stop on the side of the road to discuss anything that might need to be done in that road service area, whether it's dig out a culvert, plow the road, remove some snow, that can be a violation of the Open Meetings Act. So we just thought it would be wise to take a look at this to enable business to get done without having to call a meeting to plow a road.
Question, how many municipal service area boards are there in the state?
Do you know that most of them are actually in the Fairbanks North Star Borough?
Do we use a different model in Anchorage?
I believe you have some road service areas as well, but in a lot of boroughs they just don't even have them. This only really affects a few boroughs.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I think with the unified municipality you have road powers. Generally, service areas are only in those boroughs that don't, where the borough government does not have road powers. General road power. So it's only where a neighborhood or a smaller sub-community decides to form that boundary.
Assume those powers right. themselves. Right. Yeah, I think we have road service districts, don't we? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I thought.
Hillside in particular.
Hillside, right. And how many members do the road service area boards have? Are there five, seven?
Three, as yeah. a rule.
So that's the problem. It's such a small board.
Right, and under the Open Meetings Act, and correct me if I'm wrong, I believe you people probably know more about this than I, but under the Open Meetings Act, three or more constitute a quorum for an assembly or council meeting, but an advisory board to a decision-making board requires that, states that only two people are then a quorum.
Senator Terry, do you want to address that? Is that what Section 2 is about?
I believe that's what Section 2 addresses. We do have, I believe, Renee Broker from the Borough Attorney's Office is online.
We do.
And on that specifically. And I think years ago in the Fairbanks North Star Borough, the service area, the number of commissioners that they wanted was five. They increasingly had difficulty finding five volunteers. They want to take on the responsibility and get the angry calls. You know, for they get no pay. And
they don't get the big bucks.
All the joys of public service and
that's right.
None of the perks. Anything else, Ms.
Wilson? No. Thank you very much,
Thanks so much
Chairman.
For taking the time to come here today. We do have some folks from Fairbanks who are signed up to testify, beginning with Renee Broker. Ms. Broker, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
And go ahead and put yourself on the record. Tell us who you're affiliated with, and we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Renee Broker. I'm the borough attorney for the Fairbanks North Star Borough. And on behalf of our borough, I'd like to speak in support of Senate Bill 48. It fixes what we believe are two unintended consequences of the act, and it does so without affecting in any way or diluting in any way the very important public policy goals of the act. The first change simply just says, you know, hey, we already under the OMA exempt paid employees because we recognize that you can't perform day-to-day administrative functions and provide a good service to the public and still comply with the act. That's why we exempt paid staff. What we have with respect to service areas, road and fire, they're very small. They lack the resources to hire employees. So the board ends up performing the administrative functions, and that's authorized by state law. State law already recognizes that it's necessary when you're dealing with not an area-wide power but a very small service area power to have a board to oversee the furnishing of the services in that service area. But when those boards perform these administrative functions, they're performing work that would otherwise be done by paid employees. This bill simply says and extends that existing exemption that right now is applicable only to paid employees to the very narrow circumstance when those same exact functions are instead performed by a service area board that's acting on a volunteer basis and simply wants to talk to each other about whether it's a good idea to remove the snow now or later or fix this culvert versus another one. The second change simply removes existing curious anomaly and clarifies that the same exact numerical standard that we currently apply to policy-making bodies should also apply to advisory bodies. It makes no sense, and when I do training for new boards and commissions, the utter look on their face when I explain to them that they actually live on under a lower numerical standard than bodies like our assembly who actually make decisions that, you know, we all live with. They're just making recommendations that they live under a higher standard. It makes no sense. And it really sets up what I call a trap for the unwary, for people who are simply trying to volunteer, and they end up inadvertently violating the act. And so that's why we strongly support the act, and we urge for this to get moved out of the committee. And thank you very much. That concludes my remarks.
Thank you, Ms. Broker. I guess what I'm trying to get out is, are people being attacked because of supposed violations of the open meetings laws, or is this something you are proposing to us as a proactive measure?
It's both. You know, I've sat there when people have been attacked, and for very unintended, they did not set out to violate the act. It was very inadvertent, and it's a very painful public embarrassment for people. And we also just have people, you know, who, when we do the training, say that, you know, that's not right. And so what we have is a road service area committee that asked for us to make that change because they want to comply with the act, they want to do things right, but they're really, you know, not being able to perform the service the way they would like and comply with the act. So it's also proactive.
And last question, do you think the passage of this will somehow undermine or make it less likely that road municipal service area boards will still meet on a regular basis if we give them this, you know, what some people might call an out from having to do their normal meetings?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Kathy Wasserman is correct in that our borough, I think, is the state leader in the number of service areas. I think we have 107. And they have 8 duties under our borough code. 7 of them still require a meeting. So when they recommend a budget, when they recommend a levy, when they set out, you know, sort of their projects for the next year, all of that they still have to have a meeting for. There's only one duty, which is to supervise the actual conducting of the service and providing of the services that this act exempts them for. So, and it really actually contributes to a discussion, because right now some people have tried to do a workaround and say, well, when these decisions get made, we'll just delegate it to one person. We won't, you know, and that way we won't, they won't have to have a meeting. They can act quickly. Well, that one person then gets stuck with that entire burden, can't talk to the other two, and really the whole service area then loses out in that decision because now only one person is making it. And we'd like to have the full committee, if they'd like, you know, discuss it and decide what's best. And this actually enables that while still maintaining, they still have the requirement to make quarterly meetings, and they still have to make all their other decisions in meeting.
You make a persuasive case. Thanks so much for calling in. Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Wilikowski has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just on page 2, lines 22 and 23, you're adding a sentence that says more than three members or a majority of the members, whichever is less, are present. Do you read that current section to mean that if you have two people that get together, then that would be a violation of the Open Meetings Act?
Absolutely. And all we're doing is just taking the language, if you move up to A on line 17, that's the language that's applicable to policymaking bodies. That's the numerical standard. B, as it exists right now, has no numerical standard. So if there's a gathering, then, you know, it only takes two to have a gathering, then you've got a meeting.
And I guess, just, Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering about, because that's casting a much broader net, and I'm just wondering, I'd at least like to think through any other potential ramifications, because this is going to impact much more than just municipal service area boards. Would you agree with that?
It's a statewide definition of the word meeting, as I understand it. Yeah, I wasn't intending to move the bill today. I think it's while the section one is fairly narrow, section two is, you know, I agree. It's something we want to just probably ponder at least overnight. Mm-hmm. More comments from you, Ms. Broker?
No, that concludes my comments.
Thank you so much. Next up is Ronald Illingworth, also signed up to testify. Sir, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Go ahead and state your name for the record, your affiliation, if any, and we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Certainly. My name is Ronald Illingworth, and I'm the chair of the 23-mile Slough Road Service Area in Fairbanks North Star Borough. No affiliation with any other organization that has anything to do with this. Good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of SB 48. Current law places us in the position of choosing either to comply with the law, to ignore the law, or to find ways of circumventing the law, as was just mentioned in the previous testimony. This should not be an acceptable practice with public law. This bill addresses these concerns, specifically because AS 44.62.310 does not exempt road service areas from the public meeting requirements, as it does such things as staff meetings, for example. We are unable to conduct routine administrative or managerial duties without having a week or more notification and a subsequent public meeting. Currently, for example, we have a contract which has been established by the Borough Public Works to do maintenance on our service area roads. We're responsible for the implementation of that contract, i.e. calling out the contractor to do work that is already in the contract at a rate already established and agreed on in the contract. We cannot, the road service areas, commissioners, cannot have any discussion amongst themselves to call out our contractor without having a public meeting. For example, two road service commissioners cannot stop on the road while passing each other in a car and discuss the conditions of the road. Two road service area commissioners cannot send an email to each other to talk about plowing the road after a snowstorm. We cannot discuss whether to call out the contractor to cut brush around a stop sign or on a corner to improve visibility without having a public meeting. I've been a road commissioner for 10 years at my current residence, and before that I was a road commissioner for 4 years at a previous residence. Road service areas are a fact of life in our region. However, the current public meeting law makes it almost impossible to conduct routine business without breaking the law. Providing this exemption would let us conduct routine business without having to devise marginally legal methods of getting around the law. Interestingly, I can have a discussion with the Borough Public Works Department about our contract about the contractor, about the conditions of our service area roads, without any public meeting laws, law concerns, and be legal. But I can't have the same discussion with my fellow commissioners without having a public notice, waiting 2 weeks, and having a public meeting. Regarding a question which I think was underlying some of the other, or a concern that I think was underlying some of the other questions that were there, if we direct that one person be the point of contact or the person allowed to make the decisions for the service areas, as many of us do, how do we ensure that everybody else is notified? Decisions of the road service areas, first off, are obvious to all members of the service area. The snow's plowed, the road, the bump is repaired, the pothole is gone, whatever. We do give reports during our quarterly meetings, which cover costs incurred, recap of actions taken, and so on. Instead of delegating all authority to one person, this exemption would allow us to include all of the service area commissioners in the decision process before any action was taken. And that concludes my testimony. Thank you very much.
Mr. Illingworth, thank you. I don't see any questions for you from members of the committee. Last up to testify is Luke Hopkins. Mr. Hopkins, are you on the line?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please put yourself on the record, state your affiliation, if any, and we'd be happy to hear from you.
Yes, thank you, Senator French and other senators of the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is Luke Hopkins. I'm a Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly member and also a member of the Alaska Municipal League Board of Directors. I'll be brief. I just want to speak in favor of the current committee substitute. And as you've heard before from other members or other individuals testifying concerning the situation in Fairbanks, the two areas of amending actions in this bill are very important to us. The specific exemption concerning when two commissioners need to meet only on administrative functions when they're providing services in our road service areas is a reasonable and important action that we need to clarify. In the second section under the number of members being able to meet without having to call a public meeting by notice, I receive phone calls as an assembly member, and I'm asked why, when the elected individuals can have three people meeting to discuss various items without having to have a meeting called, why does a road service commission, fire commission members have more restrictive conditions placed upon them? And I just ask that you strongly consider that when you're as you move this bill out of committee, and ask for your recommendation on that. With that, I'll be glad to answer any questions. Thank you.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you. This bill seems to evoke a lot of emotion. Is there a particular instance that's been cited in the Fairbanks area that those of us representing Anchorage districts might not be aware of?
Senator McGuire, through the chair, from what I'm aware of, our vast numbers of service areas, both fire service and road service area commissions, probably just the sheer number of possible actions that we're always undertaking lead us to become what I think is acutely aware of the problems in applying the Open Meetings Act for our commissioners. Fire service commissioners just, you know, point the finger at us and say, why can't I speak with another fire service area commissioner about some issues that we have to deal with in maybe considering a policy recommendation or something like that before a meeting is called, which is the same conditions that, as I said, we have as myself have as an elected official in the borough. So I believe it would probably be just the sheer numbers of commissions that we have.
Just in a follow-up, so there isn't a specific instance that's occurred recently that has highlighted the issue? Or, I mean, generally there's an impetus for gathering momentum on things like this, and I'm just curious. I mean, if there is, I'm not suggesting that I disagree with the premise of the bill at all. I think you've all made very good arguments for it, particularly with respect to parity as between the assembly and those commissions. But I just feel like the committee needs to know if we're walking into some kind of ongoing complaint or something that's newsworthy in your area that we may not be privy to.
Senator McGuire, through the chair, we do have an assembly area road service commission, and it basically represents a number of representatives from road services where we've created districts because we have 107 different road service areas. And so the this was just another focal point for voices to be heard before the assembly, and they passed a resolution and passed it on to us, and the assembly passed a resolution in support of this. Just from, it seems like a reasonable, very narrow exemption consideration, and then when you get to the second section where we're asking for an amendment, you know, again, it goes back to that same issue that our commissioners don't want to inadvertently step over the line for the open meetings and a public notice request. And so when they try to, you know, again, just conduct routine business of discussing, you know, again, issues in their contracted fire department duties or in road service duties, it just seems that it's somewhat of a oversight consideration between a commissioner and an elected official for the public meeting notice. I hope that clarifies it some.
Mr. Hopkins, thank you. I don't see any other further questions for you.
Thank you very much.
Anyone else online who'd like to testify about SB 48? Anyone else here in the room that would like to testify? Hearing and seeing none, I'll close public testimony. And we will hold this bill over until the next hearing. So if there's nothing else to come before the committee, we are adjourned.